Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 93, section 3, which is old single column, page 1016. All right. So, recall that we are just getting going with this whole new block of papers on Melchizedek and the subsequent Melchizedek missionaries. And we were formally introduced to the one of the 12 Melchizedek receivers that the receivers decided needed to incarnate and engage the people that are in the immediate regions of the Near East there, set up a little headquarters, and begin to foster a little bit of a foreshadowing spiritual uplift, foreshadowing the official spiritual uplifter that the receivers knew was coming in the not-too-distant future. And so as we saw in section 2, one day there he appears on the scene. And remember how section 2 started out there? It said it was 1,973 years before the birth of Jesus that Machaventa was bestowed upon the human races of Urantia. So, mini quiz, if it was 1,973, yes, it's 1980 B.C., since Jesus was born in 7 B.C. So, yes, exactly, it's an easy number to kind of remember. 1980 B.C. is when he showed up, and, that's giving us, all the way to the year, 1,973. So it's like with Adam and Eve. They don't give us a lot of official dates, clear up some of the dates that we try to figure out historically and stuff. But they give us, some of these anchor dates that we can build around, like this one. It's like, well, okay, if I know that, this is when he arrived, exactly to the year. I can get a pretty good guesstimate of when Abraham was in play, et cetera. You can start to pin down the timeline a bit, because obviously sometimes this can be very difficult for us to pin down the timeline exactly of ancient Egypt and this sort of thing. So they're giving us a very, very precise date there. And anyway, we got him introduced, and remember we worked through some of those initial issues of why it was that he and his fellow receivers decided to that he would literally incarnate and not just modify his body energy so that he manifested in material form, which they can do. Remember, those Melchizedeks can manifest in all sorts of different forms. They have that ability. But he didn't do that. He went fully down, into the limitations of adjutant mind, as just as we are. So he's encircled in the Holy Spirit, relative to that adjutant mind. Now, he isn't merely that material mortal being. He's incarnated. So his Melchizedek nature is, in ways we can't directly understand, obviously, is is synchronized, meshed in with that material energy of that body. And as they remember how that final little paragraph there in section two, they were pointing out that, okay, he has that sort of internal, if you will, Melchizedek nature that allows him to innately be in linked in communication with his fellow receivers, but he's not aware of all the other beings, the angels and whatnot, that are on the planet, like say Adam and Eve were. Right? I mean, they could remember, they could see Kalagastia and all the seraphim and the midwayers and what have you. He's like Jesus was, right? And prior to his public ministry, he doesn't have any direct engagement with the planetary government or the celestial affairs on the planet, other than his fellow receivers. Yeah,
but he appears to know who he is and why he's there and has memory and
right.
Does he have his full Melchizedek nature to draw?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, I mean.
He knows that the other beings are there.
Right. He just has no way to, to quote-unquote see them now. I mean, so, again, we don't totally understand the physics, but you can, the point is, that in many ways that Melchizedek nature and what it can normally experience is very much imprisoned, bottled up, shackled inside, with kind of just maybe a little backdoor connection to his fellow receivers. But, through the front door, he's just like we are. We're not, there's a secondary midwayer sitting on this couch, none of us can know that. He's because he's incarnated, he's getting this very direct incorporation of our kind of mortal nature into his being, because he's got an adjuster, so he has a soul that's copying, right, the meanings and values of that that mortal nature into an immortal soul. In his case, you can literally say immortal soul instead of potentially immortal soul. It's okay. It's going to be there. And that infuses with his former pure Melchizedek nature, so that when he gives up the incarnation, he's not really a Melchizedek anymore. He's the super additive consequence of what he was before and during, subsequently. And also remember how we pointed out, because he's very much there with us as we are, he's not going to be odd. He's not going to strike people as a non sequitur. He's going to definitely make an impression. He's going to be, very wise, very sagacious, et cetera. I'm sure he's got a striking form. They didn't build just a clunky body for him. They would have built a striking body for him. So, he's going to make an impression, but in a relatively natural way. But even with as we all know, even with all that effort to not be an intense culture shock, if you will, he produces a lasting impression that is still indelible today. We're still all worked up about Jerusalem. We're still all worked up over a place that became sacred because he set up shop there.
A few others after.
Yeah, and everyone, and he set up a precedent, where in order to kind of be accepted, you had to follow suit with what he did, right? Everyone knew that anyone that was genuine would set up shop there. The original person, the prototype, set up shop there. So, he is putting boundaries on how Jesus can function when he comes, you know, 1,973 years later. I mean, Jesus is going to have to fit in to the expectations that Melchizedek produced with what he did. This is going to have lots of consequences.
Chris.
Yep.
Refresh my memory, but don't they conjecture somewhere in the book that he could end up being a finaliter down there, that he could end up, because he did this, being more than a Melchizedek?
Well,
in the long-term future of...
He's definitely going to, because he already is more than a Melchizedek. Okay, but before he was made vicegerent planetary prince, there was a lot of mystery about what his far down the road future might hold. Okay, but now you know that he will be the planetary prince of this planet, you know, until the grand universe is settled in light and life. So, you know, his, you know, finite destiny, if you will, is set because of him, I'm sure you have to say, accepting an offer that was made to him by Michael, I'm sure. Right?
Princes stay all the way until the entire...
Yeah, they... Right
or
there.
Or is it just until...
No, the princes, you know, are long-term. You know, because they become sovereigns, you know, of their world. So, so he's signed up for the long haul. Okay? But you could wonder... You know, what about those other six times in Nebanon that there was an incarnated Melchizedek? You know, they some of their futures might still be a mystery to all the revelators. We have a very special situation here. We have no idea why those others incarnated. So that was the deal. 1980 BC, we get this very significant event, the third epical revelation, and remind ourselves again, especially because of the title of the next section, okay, the third epical revelation is not his teachings. The third epical revelation is Melchizedek of Salem. It's just like the fourth is Jesus of Nazareth. It's not his teachings. I mean, the teachings are important, okay? But the real revelation is the innate faith within each of them and the potential impression, revelatory impression, that can make on others. For them to be mysterious enough, attractive enough, that people will ask some deep questions about why is Jesus like that? Why is Melchizedek like that? He seems to have a core in his nature that grounds him, like I'm not familiar with. And yet I can see it comes in very handy. Wonder if I can take on that core. Can I be born again, right, and plant my feet on that unshakable place where he's standing instead of the quicksand that I'm dancing around on right now? Right?
Yes, you can.
Right? They're there, I mean, fundamentally for that. And their teachings, you know, you might say, are a little bit more of a disclosure or a catalyst, you know, than a revelation, right? It's, you know, a revelation is fundamentally something that you can't see or hear. It's something that you have to use your insight to recognize the existence of. Right? Just like we talk about with the book. The revelation of this book is not the book itself and its words. It's what it can allow you to come to recognize that is the revelation of truth. Truth is what's revealed. Facts are disclosed. And you can see facts, right? You can hear facts. But you can't hear or see truth, which is what's revealed. You know, I'll never see your genuine faith nucleus, but I can recognize its existence with my insight, because I can tell logically there's no other way to explain what manifests from you if you don't have that nucleus inside. All right, so that's where we are. Let's see where they take us here. So we actually have him in play now, and he's going to start teaching. What does he do?
Section 3, Melchizedek's teachings. With the passing of a decade, Melchizedek organized his schools at Salem, patterning them on the olden system which had been developed by the early Sethite priests of the Second Eden. Even the idea of a tithing system, which was introduced by his later convert, Abraham, was also derived from the lingering traditions of the methods of the ancient Sethites.
Okay, so two things. One, we kind of touched upon last week. Yeah. The fun thing about the story here is, in the Bible, you have Abraham, 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 you know, and one little kind of footnote mention of Melchizedek. Melchizedek is in play. I mean, a decade has already gone by, and you still don't have an Abraham on the scene. Right? Because as we, we all know who've read this before, in a number of ways, Abraham is the part of what he was up to that is just shoring up the ball that Adam and Eve dropped, as opposed to something a little bit more original with him. All right, the stuff original with him doesn't really find residence in Abraham that much. It's more behind the scenes with the Kenites. Yeah, so that's it. Kind of turns the whole Bible story in Genesis on its head in that way, and it turns it around 180 degrees. And to that point about where Abraham fits into what Melchizedek is going to do, notice what they're emphasizing there. He's setting up these schools, and is it startlingly original how he's setting this up, the models he's using? No, he's just revivifying what was coming down from Adam and Eve with the Sethite priesthood. Now, remember, we already talked about that. He's keeping the God concept for the general populace at the most high level, at the constellation level. Right. In other words, he's sticking with Adam and Eve. He's not presuming to be a new dispensational revelation that's going to, you know, remake everything, take everything up to a higher notch, etc. So you see it there again. By and large, especially in the very generalized aspects, he's just trying to blow on the fading embers of what was coming down from Adam and Eve through the Sethites, so that there's some lingering coals, at least, when Michael shows up. That's, and the degree to which he can do a little bit of original revelation, right, he'll add that in on the side. All right. Let's see here.
Seems interesting.
Yep.
You know, a decade, 10 years, and he, you know, they had really very little communication other than word of talking to each other. They had no transportation. You know, he put all that together in a fairly reasonable period.
Yeah, and we'll be reminded as we read forward a little bit. I mean, words start spreading far and wide. I mean, people know of him a long ways away, you know, even before he exits the scene. You don't need Melchizedek missionaries to go out. The word spreads rapidly because he's in this transportation hub region, just like Jesus, you know, utilized that. So there's people are coming through there all the time. You know, he's right there in the Fertile Crescent, and so the word gets out and spreads all over in relatively short order. I'm sure just 10 years down the road, there's a lot of people a long ways away that have heard of Melchizedek. All right, let's keep going.
Melchizedek taught the concept of one God, a universal deity, but he allowed the people to associate this teaching with the constellation father of Nerlashadech, whom he termed El Elyon, the Most High. Melchizedek remained all but silent as to the status of Lucifer and the state of affairs on Gerizim. Laniforge, the system sovereign, had little to do with Urantia until after the completion of Michael's bestowal. To a majority of the Salem students, Edentia was heaven and the Most High was God.
Okay, that last sentence, that's just, saying very point blank what we were stressing a second ago. The one little twist they've thrown in, just adding to why putting all this focus on the Most High, not something higher or lower or what have you, is because you haven't had an official son come in and, you know, begin to reset things on the planet. Right? In our case, Michael hasn't arrived as Jesus yet. The Most Highs are in charge. As he's pointing out, Laniforge had little to do with Urantia, right, at this point. So it just adds to the appropriateness of them thinking, you know, the people thinking in those terms. Because the Most Highs are really the gods, the boss of the world.
So that's consistent with what Adam and Eve would have taught.
I mean, in other words, you know, Adam and Eve normally, you know, without rebellions and defaults, are teaching at the most, you know, God at the Most High level. But you can be reminded, oh, well, the fact that the Most Highs are really in charge just kind of augments that for Adam and Eve as well. And that just continues here with Melchizedek. And we'll bring up, you know, yet another issue about that later on tonight. Rest of it we've talked about many times, it's straightforward, but just emphasize that, how they say that first sentence. But he allowed the people to associate this teaching with the Constellation Father. That gentleness of approach, that humility, that patience. Think about the tension you feel, or you would feel if you put yourself in this place of, oh, but I don't know that, but that's not correct. I mean, I think I really should clear up that, you know, and, you know, could you think in appropriately evolutionary terms? Or would you start thinking in rebellious terms of getting, you know, out of sync with the evolutionary process? Could you just let them think? I mean, we've talked about this with the fifth epical revelation. We're going to have to let most people come away from this with a new, ever more self-righteous, zealous Jesusism. That's just the way it's going to be. For a lot. It's not for me right now. Okay? It doesn't, you know, in the same way with Melchizedek. I mean, there were those right from the get-go that weren't going in that limited mode. But the majority will, because these sorts of things are an evolutionary process with all the inertia and, you know, old wineskins of interpretation. So it's just the way it's going to be. Most people are... Most of the book is going to go right over their heads. Jesus, I know Jesus, right? And they do a word count, and Jesus is the most frequent you know, non-trivial word, and that just validates it for him. You know, it's up. It's telling me to go out with a new animation of Jesusism. You know, basically to you know, give people Jesus without the atonement doctrine. Okay, and all that will be appropriate in the same way that what Abraham did was very appropriate and helpful and what have you. But see, just recognize when you do that, you're just putting yourself in that mode of Abraham, right? And you're sort of just playing with the old embers that have been blowing on a little bit, but you haven't taken up the new flame of revelation.
So it says he was silent about the status of Lucifer in affairs in Jerusalem. Two things. One is that because Jerusalem was still, Lucifer hadn't been interned yet, he was still kind of active and so on and so forth, he didn't want to bring attention to the evil aspect of it?
No, it's just what they said there. It's just because the local system affairs have been usurped by the Most Highs.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, Lana Forge and Lucifer and everyone has been, you know, pushed aside, you know, for a while. The Most Highs have stepped in and they're in charge. You know, that's the main region.
This particular revelation is not silent about that.
No, no.
Which is a whole, you know, which is, when we just did a survey amongst people on what things in the Urantia book they thought would be the most interesting. And the Lucifer Rebellion was number two.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so it's kind of, I don't know why.
The boogeyman is always very popular. Yeah, I mean, you know.
the bad guys are always really popular.
Right.
Well, they're very vivid.
You know, or your fears about the bad guys and your fears about your salvation. You know, all the negativity is always very popular.
But Jesus didn't put a lot of, at least when you read, didn't put a lot of energy into it.
Right. Yeah, and yet you get his story retold in the New Testament and then evolved a little bit, you know, in the first few centuries of the church, you know, and it's just dripping with hell, you know, and Satan and what have you.
That's true.
You know? Okay. Yeah. So it didn't take long because that dual spiritism is just so natural and, like they pointed out, and of even more rudimentary than the naturalness of dual spiritism is how much more poignant negative things are, negative events, negative ideas are to us than positive ones. Right? We remember how they, you know, when they're talking about good luck, bad luck sort of stuff, you know. I mean, it's just what we consider bad is always so much more animated in our minds, right?
Yeah, that's true, and I think that these days it may be more important for us to understand the history of the rebellion, because there are shades of it, of that mindset happening now, and a lot of people don't recognize that that's the path that they may be on,
right,
or they might slide into.
Yeah, definitely. As you've heard me emphasize over and over again, that's one of the main reasons why they say so much about Lucifer in the fifth book of Revelation, because more so now than ever before in the last 200,000 years, humans are spiritual enough just by nature, because of the evolution of our natures, to stumble in to the basic sophistries of the Lucifer Rebellion, right? Anarchy is a seductive thought on, you know, both ends and all the way through the entire political spectrum, right? Is just steeped in the subtle sophistries of the so-called God of Liberty. Right, all these sorts of "you're not the boss of me" sorts of things, you know, and what's, you know, effectively, flattening everything down, you know, rejecting hierarchy, lots and lots of fascination with that. Lots of intellectual effort's been spent in dreaming up all sorts of complex political theories that are really centered on that, whether they're on the left or the right. As they point out, that difficulty with true and false liberty is the biggie, okay? and it's as Katie was just saying, it's now becoming very manifest. Remember when the sixth adjutant dawned in the collective in the middle of the 20th century? Don't be surprised if you sort of saw this fascination with anarchy kind of spread out through everyone, and it would always have a tendency on the unity biased left to be there, but you know, all the way to the depths of the right, you know, become fascinated with this as well. Ideas of, why should nations have any say about me as a businessman and my trade efforts around the world? Shouldn't trade be a voluntary association amongst cooperative groups? In other words, anarchism, right? Shouldn't it be a voluntary confederation, quote unquote, said Lucifer, right? It's just so innate now, you know, in our minds, because they're more spiritualized and they're ignorant. Everyone just naturally falls into the Lucifer manifesto. It's you can't do anything else unless you're taught otherwise. You will adopt the principles of the Lucifer manifesto. You'll start with three, then you'll go with two, and you'll end with one. No matter how much you think you won't. The only way to not do that is either to not be very spiritual, so your mind really can't go down that path, or you've been taught well, like by having a direct discussion of Lucifer in the fifth epical revelation, so it becomes clear to you, oh, I never even thought about it. I always thought Lucifer was just this, you know, material boogeyman with horns and whatnot. And, you know, no, he's my teacher in college. He's that guy that I've been, you know, admiring for the last three decades of my life. I've been holding up as my intellectual mentor.
Not really
Lucifer, but see, effectively, it might as well be Lucifer, because what's coming out of that professor or whoever's mouth is just the Lucifer manifesto.
Who caused the dawning of the Satanic?
Well, that's just the evolution, you know, of mind within the evolution of the Supreme.
So doesn't eventually the seventh count?
Yeah, that's
the hope.
Yeah, we're quivering on the very brink of the seventh dawning in the collective. But, you know, again, remember, it's just like, you know, get this relevant to what we're reading about right now. It's just like with back in Melchizedek's days. Just because the potential is there doesn't mean anyone takes a hold of that potential and actualizes it, right? I mean, the sixth adjutant dawned in the collective of the leading edge of civilization, not in all the way back in the tail, the trailing tail. They've barely gotten off the mark yet. Okay. Well, if there is no leading edge for the seventh to dawn within, okay, and that's why the book is here. It's like, okay, you're quivering on the very brink of possibly some great things, right? Beginning to dawn in the leading edge, but you're also about to cease to have a leading edge. Everyone is about to turn 180 degrees and run headlong in the opposite direction from that possibility. And so instead of getting the seventh adjutant dawning in that leading edge, you'll get an interregnum. Right? And the collective mode of the seventh adjutant will sit there twiddling its thumbs, waiting for a receiver. It's broadcasting, but there's no receivers.
Just to review that order.
Yep.
Solipsism, nihilism, anarchy.
Well, if the
manifesto.
The principles, you know, in order 1, 2, 3, I mean, are, you know, in the reverse order that he got to them. You know, so they start with the deepest depths of darkness and get, you know, less dark as you go from 1 to 2 to 3. So the first one is nihilism, because that's, you know, that's the empty endpoint that you end up with. You know, number one is nihilism. Number two is anarchism, and number three is solipsism, in the sense that I'm using that word there of, the literalness of soul, S-O-L-E, soul self-ism, of solipsism, that all you need is you. Right, your mind is innately divine. You definitely don't need to have your mind debauched by some hierarchical education regime in the cosmos or something like that. Right, all minds are innately divine. There is no hierarchy. We're everything is really a plane, and we just need to confederate voluntarily in the plane as equals. Right. Yeah. Okay. Let's see. Did we get everything there? Yeah, we got way off on that tangent, but I think we got everything there. Yeah, let's keep going. Now, remember they teased us with the concentric circles last week. Yeah. Okay. Now we're going to get to some of the meat of what they have to say about the concentric circles.
The symbol of the three concentric circles, which Melchizedek adopted as the insignia of his bestowal, a majority of the people interpreted as standing for the three kingdoms of men, angels, and God. And they were allowed to continue in that belief. Very few of his followers ever knew that these three circles were emblematic of the infinity, eternity, and universality of the Paradise Trinity of divine maintenance and direction. Even Abraham rather regarded this symbol as standing for the three most highs of Adentia, as he had been instructed that the three most highs functioned as one. To the extent that Melchizedek taught the Trinity concept symbolized in his insignia, he usually associated it with the three Verandadec rulers of the constellation of Nerlashadec.
Okay, so first of all, okay, this is where you get precisely what the three concentric circle symbol stands for, right? The three azure circles on the white background, right? No matter if you're calling it the Banner of Michael or whatever you're calling it, right? I mean, in any context, what that symbol stands for is just the Paradise Trinity, not the three infinite persons. But it has three circles because there's an internal threefoldness to the Paradise Trinity. And if you will, you can appreciate how there would be that threefoldness innate within that fourth fact of the Paradise Trinity. If you start with a single deity concept and you individuate the three individuatable elements out of it and get the deity of the three infinite persons, right, and what's left behind that is indivisible deity is that fourth fact, the Paradise Trinity. Right? I mean, if one of those downstepped facts is the universal Father, there must be the predicate, for that the sort of the seat from which you drew down that fact within the Paradise Trinity. There must be universality in the Paradise Trinity, that, you know, the individuatable aspect of which God expressed as the universal Father. Same way with the eternal Son. That means there must be, you know, eternity there, right? And in relative to that aspect, you individuated and got the eternal Son. And relative to the infinity aspect, you individuated and got the infinite Spirit. Okay. So just in that simple sense of the Paradise Trinity, you can appreciate how there would be this internal threefoldness, right? The the stumps, you know, from which you drew down the three persons. And when you think about it that way, so I mean that's what the symbol stands for, right? Not the three persons, but you know, you could say maybe this essence relative to those three persons that's within the fourth fact of Paradise Trinity. Now, did Melchizedek knows that clearly? Machaventa knows that clearly. Did he get all hung up on that, you know, and started, you know, screaming purple faced at people if they didn't quite get that? No, like they say there at the end. I mean, you know, he knows that's way too abstract, even for most people alive today, let alone 4,000 years ago. That's basically too abstract for, you know, the run-of-the-mill Urantia book reader. Okay? So he just went, you know, he was telling them about the three constellation fathers, and, you know, and he would basically just say, you know, he'd pretend like it was a symbol for the association of those three. Okay? Not even the association of the three infinite persons, because the infinite persons were too abstract for them, most of the people to wrap their minds around. But you take these three very finite persons at the constellation level and the association of them, you know, not the supersummative consequence really, but just the association of the three, and he let them, you know, he kind of basically taught that, let alone letting them run with that. Okay? Kind of just met them where they were, right? Notice that they mentioned with Abraham, Abraham could kind of get the beginnings of the supersummative consequence, as he had been instructed that the three Most Highs functioned as one. All right, so Abraham apparently was getting a little bit of a sense that it was sort of a symbolic of a fourth fact, not the association of the three, but the supersummative consequence of the three, a little bit. Just as it, you can be, you know, when you think at the, you know, about the three infinite persons, if you think about it in that bottom-up fashion to get to the Paradise Trinity, in contrast to the down, you know, top-down that we just did a minute ago, and you take the three infinite persons and you have a, you know, it's not the association of the three that's the Paradise Trinity, that's the first triunity, right? But the supersummative consequence of the three is the Paradise Trinity. A literal, organic fourth fact.
Can't wait till we get to papers 104 and 105.
Speaking of papers 104 and 105, we're going to turn for a second to paper 104. Great lead in. You can turn there if you want. At the beginning of paper 104 in section 1, which is on 1143 in the single column, I wanted to read the third paragraph of section 1 there. They're talking about how the first and second epical revelations introduced the Trinity, and the third epical revelation, as we're just reading about right now, picked up the ball again with a presentation of the Trinity. And it says right there, you see that that third paragraph in section 1, the third presentation of the Trinity was made by Machaventa Melchizedek. And this doctrine was symbolized by the three concentric circles which the sage of Salem wore on his breastplate. But Machaventa found it very difficult to teach the Palestinian Bedouins about the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the infinite Spirit. Most of his disciples thought that the Trinity consisted of the three most highs of Melchizedek. A few conceived of the Trinity as the system sovereign, the constellation Father, and the local universe creator deity. Still fewer even remotely grasped the idea of the paradise association of the Father, Son, and Spirit. And notice how they kind of were hinting at it in a deity mode there rather than an individuality mode. I wanted to read this because it isn't totally repetitive. It actually gives you a little bit more than what they gave it in what we just read. You had some of them doing the 1, 2, 3 kind of vertically with system, sovereign, constellation, Father, greater Son. Notice that they did say local universe creator deity. So you get the sense that maybe he sort of blurred the creator Son and the creator Mother Spirit together, you know, rather than trying to complicate things with, you know, fleshing those, you know, differentiating those two. But anyway, so he did what he could. He took them as high as he could, but you're getting to smaller and smaller numbers, you know, being able to take people to higher levels, at least in some minimal way.
Pretty soon it looks like our study group.
All right. So I thought it'd be, you know, great to just go back and foreshadow paper 104, which will be at, you know, not too long down the road.
Currently today, yep. In our doxology, it's God, Christ, and Holy Spirit, and then a mention of triune God.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a triunity rather than there's no even remote thinking about Trinity. It's triunity has become.
Well, it's kind of in the Abraham mode. The Trinity of Christendom is kind of sort of talked about in that mode, like they were mentioning with Abraham. I mean, you have what we would here call, you know, the universal Father, Christ Michael, and the Holy Spirit. You know, it's sort of the Trinity of Christendom, you know, there's even, for those who reflect on the New Testament precisely, they get a sense that so-called third person of the Trinity doesn't seem to be talked about really like a person, but more like a spiritual influence. See, so, you know, it's all the more appropriate to, in the Urantia Book sense, to say Holy Spirit, see, for that third one.
Holy Ghost.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you go back to an older, a little bit more, you know, personalized mode, you know, you'll say the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Okay.
But they don't necessarily look at it as a corporate thing versus a...
Well, I was just going to mention that, but if you, you know, in some, you know, more liturgical Christian settings, you know, so a little bit more scholarly Christian settings, you'll get some minimal efforts. You know, like what they said here, he had been instructed that the three most highs functioned as one, right? You'll get an instruction relative to the Trinity of Christendom of the three functioning as one in some way, right? You know, and I mean, it's obviously as time has rolled by over the last 2,000 years, a lot of Christians, you know, have lost that little measure of attempt to get more at the Trinity. And they think about it in very kind of loose fashion. But certainly in the early days when you were fighting, you know, about Trinitarianism in Christianity, you know, that was certainly, people were challenging themselves with that idea that we weren't just talking about three persons in association, but there was somehow kind of a mystical together as one thing about them.
Okay. Praying God. Okay. Singular somehow.
right. So, but you know, it's always been difficult, right, for people to go from association to supersummative consequence, you know, in a literal sense. Okay, all right. So back here, but so on the one hand, you have all these different modes back 4,000 years ago of what how people are relating to those three concentric circles on his breastplate. But for the student of the fifth epical revelation, okay, you know, get it firmly fixed in your mind. What it stands for is the infinity, eternity, and universality of the Paradise Trinity. It stands for what you're eventually going to consecrate yourself to as a finaliter. Okay? See it as, you know, as a symbol of your destiny, where you get to that, up there where the Father did his consecration, his, put himself in cooperative subordination to the Paradise Trinity, as you will, you know, in kind as a finaliter. Right? And that's what it's symbolizing. It's symbolizing that you acknowledge that you are not the whole. You are a part. Right? And but you want to benefit from the endless possibilities that the whole can bring to you, the lowly little part. And so you're going to put yourself in cooperative subordination to that. You see the great potential in humbling yourself before the whole. Right? Not only for what it can give to you just in and of yourself, but the fact that in relation to the whole, you can really relate to anyone else or anything else.
It seems like it'd be meaningless, though, to worship the Trinity or to praise the Trinity. It's like the Trinity was... Like it'd be,
it doesn't have a personality.
Seems like it'd be completely foreign to the Trinity. The Trinity couldn't care less.
But of course, see in the proper sense of the word worship in the fifth epical revelation, you know, setting aside reverence and adoration and all that sixth adjutant stuff and whatnot, right? But genuine worship is just in and of itself, no adoration, just worship, right? Is not about the universal Father. Right, it's about synchronizing with the mother deity that stems down from the existential deity of the Paradise Trinity. It is, right, putting yourself through the mother deity all the way up into relationship to the Paradise Trinity, and from there being able to get to the existential deity of the Universal Father with your adoration. Right, that worship is really about the Paradise Trinity. The adoration, no, but the worship, yes. Existentially, right, the existential nucleus of genuine worship is in relationship to the existential nature of the Paradise Trinity.
Pretty darn self-forgetting.
Right. Right. Yep.
The words divine maintenance and direction are interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, this might get you excited to go back and study the paper on the Paradise Trinity again. You know, go way back there to part one and read it again. You know, you can't read it enough times. It's a complicated concept. Go back there and, you know, and do some refresher. See if some of the things, you know, have a place to hang in your mind now where they didn't before. You know, maybe you can make sense out of some of those things a little bit better when you go back through them again. You know, look for when it talks about the functioning of that deity that is the Paradise Trinity. What kind of functioning does it have? And see if you can begin to kind of add some of those elements of lasting clarity to your what you're assembling out of the revelation. Okay, let's keep going here.
To the rank and file of his followers, he made no effort to present teachings beyond the fact of the rulership of the Most Highs of Audentia, gods of Urantia. But to some, Melchizedek taught advanced truth embracing the conduct and organization of the local universe. All to his brilliant disciple Nordan, the Kenite, and his band of earnest students, he taught the truths of the super universe and even of Havona.
Right. So, see, there's shades of the radical presentation of the fifth epical revelation that sort of were allowed to be in play because he was allowed to do an emergency revelation, an emergency epical revelation. So it didn't just start with the fifth epical revelation that the stuff is outside of the normal boxes a bit. And, you know, even think about what we just read back there. You know, those ones that were thinking that the symbol was the system sovereign, the constellation father, and the local universe creator deity. See, in other words, he gave them some sort of super universe context. Like they're saying right here, truths of the super universe and even of Havona, right? If he went beyond that, like we were just reading. Okay, so, you know, if you're not going to talk about the hierarchy, you got to kind of have the context to put the local universe hierarchy in of a super universe context of some kind. See, so he, you know, that's what they were getting at, you know, between the lines back there.
Can't think of any Urantia book readers who've named their kids Nordan yet. Yeah.
Really missing out, right? Yeah. We've got Amden, we've got Nordan, we've got these, you're going to have one in the next paragraph. These names that they're, you know, we've mentioned that before. It's a fascinating element when they toss out these names that, you know, you're not going to Google them, okay? They're not in the Bible or something. You're going, that's interesting. Why did they give me that specific name? What's up with that? All right, but you know, anyway, I've already pointed out the main thing, you know, that you've got, right away, you can tell here, he's setting up these two parallel streams. You have the main, what he's doing to the main evolutionary stream, and then there's that parallel stream that's really embodied within the Kenite lineage. That parallel stream he sets up, you know, and that's eventually going to give rise to Moses, right, that can inject himself into the main evolutionary stream and drive it forward in a way that it can't drive itself forward. All right. Even notice the rulership of the Most High's Evidentia, gods of Urantia. They aren't literally personalized deity, right? The Rhonodex, they aren't literally gods. Okay, but not only in sort of the spirit of his revelation or Adam and Eve's revelation, you know, they're effectively God or gods. But because of the rebellion and the Most High's, you know, assuming rulership, okay, I mean, they're effectively, you know, godlike in that, you know, especially if they put forward a regency, yeah, I mean, they're going to act as if they were absolute beings, right? I mean, they have absolute authority, and they're not, you know, their edicts are not even questionable, okay? Not going to appeal to some court or something, right? And try to get an injunction, right? No. All right, so they are very much, you know, quote unquote, gods of Urantia. Okay, keep going.
They said, they used that term for Caligastia. They said, who was once termed god of Urantia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you've got the god of liberty and the god of Urantia, you know. That's just another point of how there's some validity to that. It's like, okay, if you want to use that expression, God of Urantia, okay, it's the Most High's, right? It's not Caligastia and his delusion. Yeah, right.
The members of the family of Ketro, with whom Melchizedek lived for more than 30 years, knew many of these higher truths and long perpetuated them in their family, even to the days of their illustrious descendant, Moses, who thus had a compelling tradition of the days of Melchizedek handed down to him on this, his father's side, as well as through other sources on his mother's side.
Right, and then there's what came in from his father-in-law as well, you may recall, when we get to Moses, they'll remind us of that. So, yeah, I mean, Moses was distilling out of that parallel stream kind of from every direction. All right, and I mean, obviously I don't know for certain how to pronounce that. I wouldn't be surprised if it's Ketro. A lot of those words, they tend to have the consonant and the vowel together as a syllable with a long vowel and then the rest of the word. But I don't know for certain. Like Mo says, for instance, you know. That's a common way, I think, that a lot of I always just take it kind of fully Englishized, if you will, and say Kenite. But the degree to which they're sort of playing off of a Hebrew there, I mean, a lot of people will pronounce that Kenite instead of Kenite. But, you know, when you're using that I-T-E suffix, right, you basically have some word and then you stick ite on it, right? You have K-E-N, you have Ken. Okay, you're sticking ite on it. But it's not K-E and you're sticking night on it, like Kenite. But that pronouncing it that way may be a little bit closer to the word that it's playing off of in Hebrew, right, that has a long vowel. Okay.
What are the vowels in Hebrew?
No, I don't know. That's all complicated. They just have the marks on the consonants for the vowels.
Okay. That's how they do it.
And that gets into the whole thing. If you have YHWH and you don't use the vowel marks for Yahweh, right, for the vowels there, you know, and you put in the vowel marks for Adonai instead, Lord, and so you put YHWH and the vowel marks for Adonai together, you get Jehovah. Right? See, and remember that was the way you weren't supposed to pronounce Yahweh. It was too sacred to say out loud. The reminder in the Hebrew text that you should say Adonai is you've got the vowel marks for Adonai there on the YHWH. Just as a reminder to the reader to say Adonai when you get to that word, not the word that you're not supposed to say, Yahweh. But then if you take that literally, you get Jehovah. All right, anyway, but not enough about Hebrew that I know so little of.
Enough not to get killed, though.
I don't know. The stuff I just said about Jehovah, could get me in trouble. Back to this. So he's living with his family for more than 30 years. That's kind of an interesting little tidbit, okay? Just takes residence on their couch and never leaves.
Three generations.
On the couch with the breast plate.
That's just kind of, it's just fun to have, these genuine things about his actual life instead of the little tidbits in the Bible, which all end up being kind of mystical and you don't really think of them in straightforward corporeal fashion, He certainly never ate or slept or anything, He was like a mystical being, or something. Yeah. All right.
Melchizedek taught his followers all they had capacity to receive and assimilate. Even many modern religious ideas about heaven and earth of man, God, and angels are not far removed from these teachings of Melchizedek. But this great teacher subordinated everything to the doctrine of one God, a universe deity, a heavenly creator, a divine father. Emphasis was placed upon this teaching for the purpose of appealing to man's adoration and of preparing the way for the subsequent appearance of Michael as the son of this same universal father.
So, appealing to that adoration, in other words, he's going to try to strengthen a monotheistic concept and definitely get it exalted so people are turning their thoughts upward to it, right? And not some triviality at eye level, right, that you're going to have a sword fight with or something. And so if you get that monotheistic notion, whatever specifically is in their head, and a little bit of an elevated one, okay, that's something that Jesus can refer to and say, I come down from that thought you have on high, and I come from that sky father. Okay. Yeah. That's another way to think about it. I mean, he's basically going to spawn a sky father concept. And so you're going to end up with Zeus or Jupiter or whomever, right? I mean, many, many peoples that have Andite influence or Melchizedek teaching influence have some, way back at least in the mists of their mythology, a sky father. They have this, see, exalted monotheistic thing that Melchizedek was fundamentally trying to foster the conception of. Just notice again, we have man, God, and angels. Remember when we were talking about the concentric circles, we had men, angels, and God there, and how they're saying that a lot of what he was teaching is still basically about all the run-of-the-mill religionist has today. Think about if you showed the three concentric circles to someone that doesn't have, some immediate maybe tendency to go to the Trinity of Christendom with it, but a little bit more generalized person,
It looks like a bullseye.
What would they come up with?
UPS.
Right. I mean, if you tell them that it has something to do with God or whatnot, and such heavenly affairs. Right? I mean, well, let's see, I don't know, there's heaven and earth, and it's like, okay, so God is in heaven, and we're down on earth. Oh yeah, and then there's the angels that kind of go in between the two. Well, that's probably what it stands for. Man, angels, and God in the middle. Okay? I mean, think about even a lot of people when they present the Urantia book. It's like, well, okay, I can't really give all this celestial complexity. Why don't I just call all the celestial beings angels? Right? And I'll talk about God, and I'll talk about angels, and I'll talk about man. It's really because that's about all you can expect out of most people. And if you go beyond a simple threefold thing like that, above and below, and those that go in between the two, intermediaries, it's going to be too abstract, too confusing. What's the point of it? So just notice that right there in the midst of them saying that, most those Melchizedek missionaries went out and gave everyone some basic seeds, and no one has really made much progress. Even when Jesus throws in the whole thing, you let it slosh around for 2,000 years, and you kind of just have that basic mentality, amongst Christians. Yeah, they might dual spiritize it, and have a duel for God with with the devil or Satan, and they'll have evil angels and good angels and whatnot, but But still, it's kind of just that simple concept. It's all most people are playing with. All right. Then that's just that's Guy Father concept. You know, yeah, Divine Father. Okay, so it's Guy Father, but by lifting it up, see, it's not an earthly deity; it's a universe deity. All right, and it's a, you know, and he's a creator. Remember how we talked about that? Okay, that's, you know, and that's an important thing to get it. Get him so he isn't just, like I said, some other guy that you're going to have a sword fight with or something, and he's got superpowers or something. Right? He's going to be this very transcendent concept that he literally created the heavens and the earth. He doesn't just play around in them. Right? You know, like Apollo does or something. So, yeah, he wanted to, you know, wanted to really get that more transcendent sense, like, ooh, the creator. I feel like adoring the creator, right? To get that adoration going. Yeah, did you have something you want to? No. Anyway, so that's just, you know, that's the whole point. And they can have a limited, literal conception, you know, as they, you know, are kind of inescapably bound to, it doesn't matter. Right? The whole point is just to get the basic essence in play, and Jesus can play off of that essence and help to clear up, you know, strengthen it. It's not the material Father. He's a spiritual Father. He's right. God is not a material technique. He's a spiritual technique, and Jesus can try to strengthen it. But you know, first you've got to get something that's lifted up a little bit. All right.
Melchizedek taught that at some future time another Son of God would come in the flesh as he had come, but that he would be born of a woman, and that is why numerous later teachers held that Jesus was a priest or minister forever after the order of Melchizedek.
All right, so we brought that up last week when you were introducing, you know, that whole concept that, you know, it's there usually in, you know, one of the Psalms, and then gets very much talked about in Hebrews for Christians. But even the Jews, you have the predicate, you know, have that basic sense along this line, that there's not just the priesthood after the order of Aaron, like Moses' brother Aaron, that you there's a priesthood that is fundamentally bringing in that which goes beyond the pure Hebrew tradition. Priests, you know, the order of Melchizedek concept. And see that, you know, the fact that when they rewrote all the stories about the interactions between Abraham and Melchizedek, they basically replaced Melchizedek with, you know, by Yahweh, you know, and told the story as if Abraham was talking to God. You know, except for that one time, of course, in Genesis, where, you know, there's the whole bread and wine thing with Melchizedek and all. I mean, it's mysterious, but they had to leave in one little nugget to have this, you know, a little subtle thread of that. You know, we're not saying that all there can be is priests of the order of Aaron. There's a very special parallel sort of order, and that, see, and Jesus' followers, he definitely picked up on that. It's like, ah, finally, that's what's really been brought out of the shadows, you know, and and is being uplifted is this whole new order of a priesthood, if you will. Okay, so that's what's there. And notice that he's, you know, Melchizedek is being very direct. He's telling him he's going to be incarnated, right, at conception and be born of woman, and, you know, unlike him, you know, and all that gets basically carried forward so that in Hebrews, right, it says that Melchizedek was different. You know, he wasn't born of woman, you know, like Jesus was. I mean, those stories held together for 2,000 years, enough where the basic elements of them could be written down in Hebrews, for instance. Okay, that, so, he, you know, they didn't, you know, they're just telling you that, you know, that was, he gave him that, Melchizedek gave him that difference right up front. I didn't have a mom and dad, okay, but the next one that comes will. All right.
And thus did Melchizedek prepare the way and set the monotheistic stage of world tendency for the bestowal of an actual paradise son of the one God, whom he so vividly portrayed as the father of all, and whom he represented to Abraham as a God who would accept man on the simple terms of personal faith. And Michael, when he appeared on earth, confirmed all that Melchizedek had taught concerning the Paradise Father.
So there you're just saying not only did Jesus had to kind of fit into the expectations that Melchizedek established, you know, he, as I was just saying a minute ago, he picked up the threads and carried them forward as well. Validated, confirmed. So both kind of positively and negatively, you know, both, actively and passively, Jesus is stepping into this established context from Melchizedek. You know, and we, that whole bit about the simple terms of personal faith, remember we were right up front tonight when we were talking about, you know, what the names of the two revelations are, that it's Melchizedek of Salem and Jesus of Nazareth. It's their faith. See, they have that in common, like they're saying there. And, you know, the whole, you know, the whole basic point is that God accepts man on the simple terms of personal faith. Take me, for example, right? I'm in God's favor because of my faith. They can both say that. And then they can challenge those who are listening to figure out what this word faith refers to. Yeah, but they're saying that you have to found yourself anew with this faith nucleus, which is tied to eternity where God is. That's how you're in God's favor. So, you know, you start with God instead of trying to end with God. Yeah, that's another way of thinking about what they're trying to, you know, the basic message they're trying to preach. Yeah, think about how different, say, an Eastern concept is. Even though you don't have God, you just have, you know, say, you know, Brahman or whatever. But, yeah. It's very much all about some ending point. And, you know, and in the early stages can be very lowly. I mean, maybe you're reincarnated as an insect or something, okay? So it's just completely opposite, you know? And say, no, you start in glory and go forward from there rather than thinking you start in, you know, in darkness and maybe end in glory. And it's just turning everything around like that. You're not by nature sinful and unclean. Right? And Melchizedek and Abraham, I mean, Melchizedek and Jesus both tried it, and still you've got Christians starting out their worship service with, I'm by nature sinful and unclean. 4,000 years, and, you know, still, no. Yeah, it's just very difficult. You know, you had Martin Luther trying to, it's like, what about grace? Right? Trying to remind people, what about grace? You know, and you hear me stress that all the time. What are you given by grace? You know, you start with amazing glory. Your encirclement in the Holy Spirit is a supreme thread. Right? You start with the ending. No, I mean, that it's just, it's so important to turn things around like that. Finally pick up the message that's been taught to us for the last 4,000 years instead of just reverting back to the whole debt mode, like, you know, we were just reading about in the evolution of religion, you know, where you just start out, you know, less than zero, right? You're in a deep hole, you know, and maybe you can hope after endless, you know, cycles of eternity to get to zero, right, or something. It's just such it's so difficult to break out of that deficit mentality about your relationship to God.
And we end up using these gifts to double down on that.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, like,
right.
Like, to be brilliant and being small.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you bring up a really interesting point there, and that almost all religions have that philosophy, that, you know, whether it's original sin or you're not worthy, or
right.
You know, and so on and so forth.
Right.
And the transition from that to the truth that we were just talking about, even though it sits here right in front of you,
mm-hmm.
is something to contemplate in terms of what are those steps that people are going to have to go through, or are they going to be suddenly, you know, by reading Revelation? In other words, so it's that, to me,
mm-hmm.
If the majority of people who are religious believe that, the world would be in a whole lot different situation than it is right now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Whether it's the devil taking them over, or they're originally sinful, or they're not worthy, and, you know, I'm God, you know, one of my, doesn't love me unless I do this, and that, you know, and it's like a...
right, if you started with the gift rather than the debt... Just how, if you started with the gift rather than the debt, just like you're saying, how different would everything be? And it's a complete reorientation of your whole mind. Hence, you're going to think about everything differently. Yeah, it would be so transformative if we could begin with a recognition of the gift.
I mean, like, I do pastoral care ministry at the church, you know, going to people, most of them are dying, and the number one thing they want to know is, have I been good enough?
Right. Have I paid enough of my debt to make it to the next life? Yeah.
Exactly. It's like, yeah. It's so, you know, I kind of say, well, I guarantee you, you know, God loves you, you know, don't worry about it. Are you sure? How can you be sure? I've never been taught that.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm serious. It's like a real thing.
Uh-huh.
And it's fear. And it's like, you know, you sit there and you go, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That in itself, just that whole concept changing would do a ton, you know, from an internal spiritual uplift.
Yeah. Melchizedek.
Not all the knowledge in here.
Yeah. Melchizedek taught and taught and taught it, and everyone just said, yeah, right. Like you start with a gift, and all you have to do is take a hold of the gift. No, you start in debt. We've always known that. I mean, you can have an incarnated Melchizedek tell you. You can have an incarnated Creator Son tell you, and the humans just say, yeah, right. Like, you know what you're talking about. Hey, we all know you start in debt. I mean, we just will not accept. Yeah. So, but if you can overrule that natural debt thought, you can probably get to all these other wonderful, unnatural, genuinely religious starting points that you also need to add, right? To your beginning set of assumptions.
The difficulty, though, isn't it? The difficulty of recognizing spirit, because spirit is does a gift.
Yeah.
It's totally a gift. It
yes.
Can't be anything else.
Exactly. I mean, you know, you can think of it. See, it's a complete package. I mean, like you've heard me say so many times, if no one really knows what free will is, right? They think free will is about mind over matter, right? Self-assertion. It's like, no, free will is about spirit over mind. What? Spirit over mind? What's that? Right? I mean, so it's because we're lucky if we have a duality, you know, of matter and mind, you know, let alone threefold with spirit. I mean, again, see, it's just... everything is self-consistent with this. I mean, there's no way to recognize the gift if you don't recognize how you have a sovereign ability to use spirit to reframe your mind. I mean, no wonder you don't, you know, aren't thankful for the gift. You're completely unaware of the whole domain where the gift exists. You can't see the gift and you consider mind over matter. Right, there's no gift to be found there. This fact that it's sad to record that almost no one has a genuine inner life consciously, right? Or they would know the gift, but they don't. All they know is the apparent debt.
Well, in relationship to civilization, I am in debt. Am I not? To all those who came before me and did
sure, remember
they did to build it up. Yeah, I'm in debt.
Yeah, remember they talked about that, how you know everything kind of seems to validate and confirm and strengthen this debt, you know, notion as a foundational assumption. Yeah, that's the thing. See, when all you think about is mind and matter, it leads you to that foundational assumption of debt. The outer life speaks of debt, but the inner life speaks of gift. Right?
Okay.
And like I just said, the fact that no one recognizes the gift is because no one really has a conscious inner life. Right? That's why you can't look up the word faith in the dictionary. Right? The definition in the dictionary is a lower domain in the hourglass analogy definition instead of an upper domain one. Like it's genuinely is. Yeah, the best thing in the dictionary is about some musings in the lower domain of the hourglass analogy. Some feeling or whatever.
No, sometimes they quote Paul. Got a little bit of opportunity.
Yeah. But yeah, it's just like I said though, but you still, you know, don't see the definition in the dictionary challenged by Paul. The definition is still credulous belief in the dictionary. So, yeah, it's just so difficult for us to get into this because it's a complete package. Everything about this issue, we've coordinated into a systematic false philosophy, right? That is, like I just said, at best encompassing some mind matter or at least feeling matter worldview. But spiritual? No. There just isn't. You know, it's just so difficult for us to wrap our minds around what the word spiritual actually is referring to. That it's referring to this ability to unnaturally frame your mind. That's what makes you spiritual, not some fuzzy feeling in your head, you know? I mean, no, spirit, you know, every time you see the word spiritual in the book here, think, oh, that's referring to me unnaturally framing my mind, taking hold of spirit and using spirit over mind to reframe my mind, to give my mind new boundary conditions, a new set of initial assumptions, a new framework within which to function. That's what makes you spiritual. The and God is all about, you know, when Jesus says he's your spiritual father, see, he's about that reframing of your mind. He has nothing whatsoever to do with material affairs or your feelings about material affairs. And he's not your material father or your feelingful father. He's your spiritual father, right? The only thing he relates to is reframing your mind.
Which, of course, puts you in charge of the rest of that stuff easily.
Yeah. And since you're sovereign there, see, you know, he's not going to reframe it for you. He's going to give you potentials, but it's in your hands whether or not, you know, you actualize any of that.
Section 4. The Salem Religion. The ceremonies of the Salem worship were very simple. Every person who signed or marked the clay tablet rolls of the Melchizedek Church committed to memory and subscribed to the following belief. 1. I believe in El Elyon, the Most High God, the only universal Father and Creator of all things. 2. I accept the Melchizedek Covenant with the Most High, which bestows the favor of God on my faith, not on sacrifices and burnt offerings. 3. I promise to obey the 7 commandments of Melchizedek and to tell the good news of this covenant with the Most High to all men.
Okay, so you can see, I mean, it's not some fuzzy collective that he's setting up here. It's very definitive, right? They have to sign or mark the clay tablet rolls, and they, you know, they have to commit to memory, right? You know, okay. So he's definitely, you know, setting up a very solid system. So no wonder there was a vast subsequent Melchizedek missionary ship that, you know, went out. Okay. He's, you know, in some ways here, see, you know, much more direct about doing something like this than even Jesus was. Yeah. So, that's kind of an interesting element that you can feel it being a lot more in the mode of what Adam and Eve, you know, were doing or would have done, and what the prince's staff, you know, did, where the teachings are a definitive element. Even though he's the revelation, Melchizedek of Salem, you know, those Edenic teachings and those Dalmatian teachings, okay, you know, you can see, you know, and sure enough, the 7 commandments are being brought forward very definitively, just like Adam and Eve brought those forward again and the prince's staff inaugurated.
Okay. Jesus had his too.
Right. Jesus was, you know, he didn't really invoke such an institutional initiation thing like this. See, yeah, sure, a little bit, you know.
I meant two, not T-O-O.
Yeah, I know what you meant. Yeah, right. You know, Jesus did that stuff a little bit, right? The remembrance supper. He did a little bit of institutionalization, but in many ways that was kind of a fallback position, you know, that he did some of those things. Here, it's obviously very much up front. He was planning on setting up some institutionalization here. Okay, and you can't help but think of the shades of the Apostles' Creed or something, you know, and the only universal Father and Creator of all things and things like that. Okay. So he's definitely kind of setting up some creed sort of things here and whatnot. There's that faith element, and he's directly going to challenge sacrifices and burnt offerings. Okay, I'll bet he's not very successful at that. What do you think? Let me think. When Jesus came along, were there sacrifices in the temple? Let me think. we read about how definitive people latched onto that, and but he's
burnt offerings may have been calmed down.
He's taking it on. He's and then just over and over again, you can see how convenient it is that the normal mode, staying with Adam and Eve and revealing up to the constellation level, so that it's the Most High. You know, what were they just saying about the monotheism? You know, he was wanting to get this monotheistic God and lift it up. It's just kind of right there in calling him the Most High. Right, it just forces it up. So it's very convenient that that's the mode he's in. It just automatically does that exaltation. Every time he invokes it, he's reminding him, lift your eyes up to look towards God. Don't look in the plain. All right?
And that was the whole of the creed of the Salem colony. But even such a short and simple declaration of faith was altogether too much and too advanced for the men of those days. They simply could not grasp the idea of getting divine favor for nothing by faith. They were too deeply confirmed in the belief that man was born under forfeit to the gods. Too long and too earnestly had they sacrificed and made gifts to the priest to be able to comprehend the good news that salvation, divine favor, was a free gift to all who would believe in the Melchizedek covenant. But Abraham did believe half-heartedly, and even that was counted for righteousness.
Yeah, remember the quote-unquote there from Genesis about counted for righteousness. They're just pointing out that it was technically a half-hearted issue, but it was something. We've already brought up a number of these issues. Like I was saying way back to the beginning here tonight, you can't see faith. Therefore, in the minds of these peoples, if you can't see it, it doesn't exist. It's nothing. See? That whole idea of getting divine favor for nothing, right? Yeah. And how off that is. I mean, if you genuinely, nucleate yourself with that act of faith, that is essentially everything, not nothing. Right, you're taking a hold of infinity. In reality. But it appears to be nothing. And for the cynical person today, they look up that they see that definition of faith in the dictionary. They say, well, okay, I guess I wouldn't call that nothing. It's a credulous belief, but okay, it's a credulous belief. So, it technically is a nothing, right? It's just pure, wishful thinking and delusion.
So how does that contrast with Lucifer's thing about, hey, it's all the same, so why bother believing? In other words, you got it anyway. It's not for nothing, really.
Well, think about that principle number one, the nihilistic principle, the first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. See, when all is said and done, Lucifer ends up right where these people are. Right? I mean, see, that's the thing about what happened with Lucifer. He ends up basing his whole theory of reality on appearance, which means there really isn't reality. So it's actually a theory of nothing. It's nihilism, right? I mean, it's just,
As opposed to faith by
the more you you don't recognize the validity of insight and just go with the appearance, whether or not you're really fancy intellectually like Lucifer was, or you're the run-of-the-mill person, you know, thinker today, the more you focus on appearance and sight and dismiss insight, the more you're dismissing reality, and it just the more it will just, you know, I'm just kidding. It really is just nothing, right? You don't feel the substance of reality because it can't be felt in the appearance. The appearance is not reality. It's the appearance.
The appearance is more vivid.
Right?
It's just how we always stumble.
Right. It's vivid, but right, it just... It there's no reality response to it. See, so you end up not feeling a reality response, and it's like, well, okay, there's no reality response, therefore there really is nothing. See, again, it's like, no, just because you're not using your reality response, don't project that and assume that means that there's really nothing. No, it just means that you're really not using your reality response to recognize
reality.
The reality.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. But you can see how it's just right there. It's unnatural. See, and when all is said and done, no matter how fancy Lucifer was, he ended up being wholly natural.
Yeah.
And it's natural to end up with nihilism. But the simplest unnatural act of faith bounds you infinitely away from that emptiness. Right? Instead of ending with nothing, you begin with everything. The simplest person exercises that little act of faith. You know, read the preface to paper 102 again. Okay? the contrast is whether do you recognize the gift mode or not? Right, where you recognize that you're really starting with everything by grace. You know, and right here you saw, right? I mean, but Melchizedek just wasn't getting anywhere. I mean, he couldn't convince them that man wasn't born under forfeit to the gods.
Yeah.
The debt notion, right? And the sacrifice that goes with that debt notion.
And if you didn't sacrifice, you probably owed interest.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
The sacrifices are all material.
Yeah, right, of course. Okay. They simply could not grasp the idea. And as we talk about all the time, that's the big challenge of the fifth epical revelation. I mean, even the simplest things in the fifth epical revelation require abstract thinking that almost no one has now naturally. You know, through some educational process, quote unquote, naturally. And the deep things in the book, you know, are 10 orders of magnitude beyond what anyone has attempted before. Okay. So, you know, the very fact that most humans on the planet still can't get to gift and are stuck in the debt mode. I mean, are they going to understand the difference between deity and reality in paper 105? No. All right. So there you see it, right, just like we were talking about. But again, I'll emphasize how it starts out. And that was the whole of the creed. I mean, Jesus did not lay out creeds. And he didn't even want to lay out a prayer. Okay, I wrote prayer. Not a lot of creed. Okay, so Machiavelli is, you know, he's engaging the more system, if you will, a lot more than Jesus did.
He was lifting it from a lower position. So.
Yeah. Yeah, he wasn't bringing, significant originality. He was, you know, just trying to reawaken this, the stuff that was given before in by proper dispensational revelators. Okay, but still, I mean, a lot more to, you know, the Moray system or to civilization, if you will, than, you know, directly than Jesus as the spiritual uplifter. Okay.
The seven commandments promulgated by Melchizedek were patterned along the lines of the ancient Dalmatian supreme law and very much resembled the seven commands taught in the first and second Edens. These commands of the Salem religion were: 1. You shall not serve any god but the Most High Creator of heaven and earth. 2. You shall not doubt that faith is the only requirement for eternal salvation. 3. You shall not bear false witness. 4. You shall not kill. 5. You shall not steal. 6. You shall not commit adultery. 7. You shall not show disrespect for your parents and elders.
Okay. So notice what they say in the preface there. He's, you know, reanimating, if you will, the seven commandments that go all the way back to Dalmatia. But it is going to be kind of in some of the specifics, more in the Adam and Eve mode, where he's going to talk about the Most High and what have you, that, you know, the prince's staff didn't do. So let's just remind ourselves of how that works. You know, if you go back to paper 66 about the planetary prince of Urantia, if you go to section 7, which is old single column page 751, where the seven commandments are. You know, let's just remind ourselves of how Hap put things forward and what, you know, in that code that he called the Father's Way. You know, and just compare them point to point. So his first commandment, 500,000 years ago, remember, was, "You shall not fear nor serve any god but the Father of all." Okay, and here, Melchizedek is, "You shall not serve any god but the Most High Creator of heaven and earth." So, two things there. One, notice Hap had, "You shall not fear nor serve." In Melchizedek, "You shall not serve." So you drop the fear part. Now, whether or not Adam and Eve dropped the fear part, I don't know. But Adam and Eve, you know, would have definitely gone into the Most High mode, like Melchizedek is in here, where, you know, it was kept, you know, relatively general back there with the prince's staff. Okay, and then number two, this is where, you know, really is interesting to think about the difference. So back there with Hap, you have, number two is, "You shall not disobey the Father's Son, the world's ruler, nor show disrespect to his human associates." So very much in the prince and his staff mode. Yeah. See? Obviously, Adam and Eve and Melchizedek, you know, wouldn't been are not going to be in that mode. Melchizedek says, "You shall not doubt that faith is the only requirement for eternal salvation." So the faith one is what takes the place of all of that identification with the planetary prince. And, you know, so because you don't have any way to kind of get yourself attached effectively to eternity with individual, you know, or with external individuals, yeah, right, you need to go to that internal nucleization point of your faith nucleus.
Yeah. It's couched in negative language. Thou shalt not.
Yep. Yep.
Doubt.
Right. It's still going to be taboo mode, right?
Yeah.
Right.
So before you go on with that one point.
Yep.
it seems that because of the fact that we went through this, you know, rebellion and rebellions, etc., is that we are tested much more to exercise our faith.
Yes.
Than most people in most worlds would.
Yes, exactly. Like I was just saying, on the normal world, you kind of have the moolah sort of thing happening, right? You've got these external authorities that you identify with. And see, and it's a much more long-term project to slowly transition from that crutch to taking it on internally in your inner life, stretched out over long spans of time in a normal world. But here, you know, sort of baptism by fire, right? I mean, we lost all that. So, you know, you've got to go to where everyone eventually has to get to anyway. You need to do it up front, right? You know, and you can pretend that there are moolahs, but there really aren't. Really, you need to use your encirclement in the Holy Spirit and your personality, and you have to take a hold of your faith nucleus. You have to identify with eternity directly by internal grace and not kind of draft off of its downstepped expression in the external world.
So this is the Agendoner difference.
Yeah, the Agendoner difference. Right.
Interesting. Has this helped you understand that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And
what
happened?
Yep.
Is it a curse or a blessing? Well, pretty interesting.
Yeah, and even in this formulation, it kind of ends up as credulous belief.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, you notice that, you know, he would have had limited success getting anyone to have a proper sense of what the word faith refers to. But he would just let them, it's like, well, okay, credulous belief, I'll let them roll with that. But that core group of Kenites, you know, he could have gotten them to perhaps recognize the genuine inner life better.
But what a culture that family must have had that he lived with, Catrus.
But it is interesting, not that you should have faith, but you shall not doubt that faith. You know, like Gene was pointing out, you know, that he knows that he can't challenge the initial taboo modality. You know, I mean, he's got to kind of stick with that. That's a long process to be able to flip it from the negative to the positive.
Yeah. Quite a soft shoe he's got going.
Yeah. Okay, and then after those first two, right, then it gets a little bit more straightforward. Melchizedek says, you shall not bear false witness. You know, what did you have back with Hap? You shall not speak a lie when called before the judges of the people. Okay, basically the same, but it's being presented in pithier fashion, right? See, he's, you know, it's not so wordy. What Melchizedek, you have, you shall not kill. Whereas back there you had, you shall not kill men, women, or children. Right, you know, because they're speaking more to children. You got to spell everything out more. Right? You shall not steal. Okay, back there you had, you shall not steal your neighbor's goods or cattle. Okay. Melchizedek, you have, you shall not commit adultery. Back there, you had, you shall not touch your friend's wife.
Right.
You're
just spelling it out.
Yeah, it's just much more, yeah. Spoon fed, if you will. Yeah. And then finally, Melchizedek has, you shall not show disrespect for your parents and elders. Back there, you shall not show disrespect to your parents or to the elders of the tribe. Almost the same, except, you know, yeah, it's much more acknowledging the tribal modality back then. Okay. So isn't that kind of interesting to just...
That's a lot of fun.
To directly reflect on that contrast. Okay, so there's... So he's... So, so the, and remember, that was... item number three, you know, was the seven commandments, you know, so we're just fleshing out item number three that we had there in his, in Melchizedek's creed thing that he was getting them all to subscribe to. Yeah, and so they need to obey the seven commandments, and they're now the seven commandments of Melchizedek. like John was saying, Melchizedek is plagiarizing him and making him the seven commandments of Melchizedek. All right, what else do we have here?
While no sacrifices were permitted within the colony, Melchizedek well knew how difficult it is to suddenly uproot long-established customs, and accordingly had wisely offered these people the substitute of a sacrament of bread and wine for the older sacrifice of flesh and blood. It is of record, Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine. Unquote. But even this cautious innovation was not altogether successful. The various tribes all maintained auxiliary centers on the outskirts of Salem, where they offered sacrifices and burnt offerings. Even Abraham resorted to this barbarous practice after his victory over Chedorlaomer. He simply did not quite feel at ease until he had offered a conventional sacrifice. And Melchizedek never did succeed in fully eradicating this proclivity to sacrifice from the religious practice of his followers, even of Abraham.
Okay, that's Chedorlaomer, excuse me. Yeah, that CH is like Chris. That's Greek Chi, yeah, so it's not Ch. All right, so yeah, we already talked about this. Obviously, they're not going to give up all the sacrifice stuff. And so you've got this whole game, but you do have, you know, him. He acknowledges that he's got material pragmatism. He's not a hopeless idealist, you know, Melchizedek. And so he makes an effort to do a substitute thing, same thing like Jesus is trying to do. And of course, Jesus does it that way because Melchizedek did it that way. I mean, Jesus didn't dream that up, Melchizedek did. So that whole bread and wine sacrament. And, remember when we were talking about sacrament, that sacred bit, you know, and all that, the whole evolution of that relative to cannibalism and everything we read about. But an important little sidelight, you know, when they quote from Genesis, you know, part of that little chunk that's in Genesis that directly refers to Melchizedek, you know, that Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought forth bread and wine, part of that passage. How does it start out there? It says, it is of record. Quote, Melchizedek, etc. So if you're reading in the Urantia book and you come across the expression, the Melchizedek of record, which Melchizedek is that referring to? Machaventa Melchizedek. Not Mantusha.
All
right. Right. Who's involved in the, you know, in part four of the book? Machaventa, not Mantusha. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those who originally were studying the book, you know, mixed that up. We'll just leave it at that. The Melchizedek of record is an obvious individual. Mantusha is not a Melchizedek of record. Okay, so there's that little sidelight, but what else we have there? So with Chedorlaomer, it's hard to get all those syllables in there. So that's, you know, there's this whole story in Genesis you may be familiar with, all, you know, these armies and battling, you know, that what's in the Bible has all been reworked and whatnot, just like making Melchizedek, talking with Abraham, God talking to Abraham, you know, all those stories got reworked. And you know, that whole victory, you know, it's not just the bread and wine thing. You know, you also have that issue of, you know, Abraham, you know, destroying all these armies. Okay, so let's just remind ourselves again another issue here. Let's see, what paper is this? This is clear back in the Constellations paper. That's paper 43, section 5, which is a old single column, page 491. Let's flesh out the rest of that story a little bit. Every quarantined or isolated world has a Veronidex sun acting as an observer. He does not participate in planetary administration except when ordered by the Constellation Father to intervene in the affairs of the nations. Actually, it is this Most High Observer who rules in the kingdoms of men. Urantia is one of the isolated worlds of Nerlaishadec, and a Veronidec observer has been stationed on the planet ever since the Kalagashya betrayal. When Machaventa Melchizedek ministered in semi-material form on Urantia, he paid respectful homage to the Most High Observer then on duty, as it is written. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, was the priest of the Most High. Melchizedek revealed the relations of this Most High Observer to Abraham when he said, "And blessed be the Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand." Okay, that's the rest of that passage about, you know, because it's in the wake of those wars, or that war. And I wanted to go back and read you this, because notice they've added an additional twist with this whole bit about talking about God as Most High. I mean, in a generalized sense, he's using that to refer to God on high, you know, effectively the Universal Father. But as they're pointing out here, sometimes when he's referring to the Most High, he's literally making the Most High Observer kind of that God, right? You know, that it is that Most High Observer, not the Sky Father, you know, if you will, who delivered your enemies into your hand. Okay, so that's yet another element of what's in play with Machaventa talking about God as the Most High, you know, about El Elyon, is the fact that there's that Most High Observer. And he's very active. For instance, Machaventa, you know, was totally against Abraham slaughtering all those armies, but he got overruled by the Most High Observer.
Who doesn't act unless he's told?
Right. But when he does act, when he assumes, you know, a regency, okay. Right. And he acts with unquestionable authority. Okay, so I just wanted to, you know, the fact that they brought up Keter Lamer, you know, just to remind you, this is a multifaceted concept of him talking about the Most High. See, it's being played in a lot of different ways. It's serving as you know, basically the Universal Father. It's kind of acknowledging that the Most High's Constellation Fathers are in charge of the planet, not the, you know, the system sovereign, and also that the Most High Observer, you know, is literally going to be overtly, his activity is going to be overtly manifest in relating to Abraham. Okay? You know, I mean, the fact that he can literally point to a specific example of the Most High Observer intervening in human affairs. You know, try doing that today. See if you can figure out where the Most High Observer might be ruling in the kingdoms of men. Okay. So it's special circumstances, and he can use that expression in many ways. Some of them very kind of directly factual, and some more just using it in truth. Yeah.
So he couldn't actually see like all the other beings he couldn't see. But he reasoned that it must have been.
Well,
either he
recognized that, or the other receivers, you know, told him, "You got overruled, dude."
Let Abraham know. He was graced by very long. Well, he was outnumbered. So something suspicious there.
Yeah.
I often wonder what kind of being like the Most High do that would, you know, go against the people. I mean, they would give somebody a victory in a war. One wonders.
Right.
They're very efficient.
Right. He just sees to it that coincidentally, things didn't go as the other army had planned. But it's a great example of, I mean, if the Most High Observer steps in, people are going to die.
Yeah.
Okay. This isn't some sort of one warm, fuzzy, kindly mystic stepping in here. Okay. Yeah, this is the Most High Observer. And he removes kings and sets up kings. And people are going to die. It's going to go quite poorly for a small number of people for a short period of time. Okay. like we talk about all the time. All right. What else do we have here?
Like Jesus, Melchizedek attended strictly to the fulfillment of the mission of his bestowal. He did not attempt to reform the mores, to change the habits of the world, nor to promulgate even advanced sanitary practices or scientific truths. He came to achieve two tasks: to keep alive on earth the truth of the one God, and to prepare the way for the subsequent mortal bestowal of a paradise son of that universal father.
Okay, so you're already talking about the mores. Okay, like we were pointing out, he didn't come to launch some sweeping reformation of the mores. Yeah, because he's kind of more focused on the spiritual, yes. But like we were saying, it's not, he definitely engage the issue of the mores, though, a lot more directly than Jesus did.
Yeah.
Okay. So that distinction. He's like Jesus in one way and unlike Jesus, you know, in another, relative to the mores. Let's see here. Anything else? Oh, yeah. And obviously he didn't get into sanitary practices and scientific truths and what have you, right? But you could say he got closer to those things than Jesus did.
Well, the first and second, they did.
Very much so. Very much so, right? The first and second, you know, were very much about such things, yes. You can go back and look. That's your homework. they're stressing at the end. He came to achieve two tasks: keep alive on earth the truth of one God, like we saw before, the whole monotheistic thing, and having that exalted enough that it prepares the way for Michael as Jesus, so that you've got a father above that Jesus can say, "I came down from that father." So he's trying to just make it so that there can be a spiritual uplift, that Jesus will have something to work with. All right?
Melchizedek taught elementary revealed truth at Salem for 94 years. And during this time, Abraham attended the Salem school three different times. He finally became a convert to the Salem teachings, becoming one of Melchizedek's most brilliant pupils and chief supporters.
Okay, so obviously that's the little preface for next time when we actually get into Abraham. So, but you can tell, it's down the road a ways before Abraham comes into play. And even when Abraham is kind of in play, it's, well, it's not quite sticking initially. He attended the Salem school three different times. He finally became a convert. So it was a process, and we'll read about that. A very different picture in what you get in Genesis, where, Abraham is so there, at the get-go of the story and the whole point of the story. Really, what was going on back then was Melchizedek, and Abraham is a corollary phenomenon. That's a very different way to think about it, and think about how politically incorrect, if you will, that message is for an Orthodox Jew, where it's all about Abraham. Remember, sometimes it's difficult to even kind of bring Moses in, right? You can get really fixated on Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Right? But the real story is Melchizedek, which led to Moses. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are just kind of a corollary phenomenon to that. All right, so that's what we do need to talk about the main evolutionary stream in Abraham. So that's what we'll get to next time. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.